KQED.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I am so excited about our guest tonight, a cardiologist and one of the foremost experts on the future of medicine, who came up here from Southern California. Dr. Eric Topol serves as the director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute in La Jolla, California. He is also a professor of genomics at Scripps and a pioneer in the field of cardiovascular medicine. He's the author of two books, The Creative Destruction of Medicine, which examines the impact of both the genomic and wireless revolutions on the healthcare system, and most recently, his latest book was published, The Patient Will See You Now, which explores smartphones, big data, and technology in the effort to democratize healthcare. Welcome, Dr. Topol.
Well, great to be with you, Christine, and great to be here at Rock Health with this terrific group.
Awesome. So we're going to kick it off by asking a question about your books, where you've written a ton about the smartphone and other connected devices and how they're transforming healthcare, much like how the digital world has changed how we do banking or listen to music. So can you talk me through how it's different for you as a physician to treat patients today than you would have, say, a decade ago?
Right. Well, everything's changed, and I for about the last 5 years, progressively, all the devices that we used to use have been essentially replaced. They were analog devices. So if you look at a black bag for a doctor, not that they make house calls, although there's a new form of house calls, but if you look at a black bag from 1911, it was the same. For most doctors, it's still today. It has a stethoscope with rubber tubes. It doesn't record anything. That two people don't even hear the same thing. And a blood pressure cuff that you have to occlude the blood flow in the arm to get the measurement and all this stuff. So now I actually have all this other equipment which actually records things, and it's pretty good. And I can do immediately a cardiogram with every patient instead of just taking their pulse. I can see their electrical activity of their heart just through a simple thing. I can do all kinds of things we can get into. And so this little bag has all the tools, and it's probably exponentially more powerful than the thing that's been used and still being used by most physicians today.
Can you pull out one of your favorites from the bag and describe it to us?
Yeah. One of the things that's I mentioned the cardiogram, and that's still my favorite just because you can just immediately get a cardiogram. Should we do your cardiogram?
Sure. Just I feel like Colbert.
Just put your fingers on that. So it's a little device, and it's something you can put in your wallet or your purse or pocket, and so you just can pull up an app. And so when a person comes in a visit, this is the first thing that we'll do is do the cardiogram. And basically, you just pull up the app, and in a second, we'll look at your cardiogram. And you have to put two fingers on it and make a circuit with your heart. Sorry.
I got it now.
Now you got it. So here's your cardiogram.
Wow.
And it's pretty fast, right? Just in a second.
Yeah, that was a second.
Yeah, and it's perfectly
Am
normal.
Am I nervous?
No, it's great, actually. But more important than the rate is its sinus rhythm, normal pacemaker. And for a lot of patients, over 5 million people in this country have heart rhythm problems. And so they can, when they think there's something wrong, they can do this on their own now. This is a consumer-approved device. It's very inexpensive. And they can get an algorithm that tells them what it is. So they don't even need a doctor or a cardiologist anymore. So that's just one example. Another one that I am particularly fond of, specifically with the era of the smartwatch, is the glucose sensor. So I'm wearing one of these sensors that you just put on your arm or your abdomen, and you
tiny,
can put it on
like
for
a coin shape.
Put it on for a couple of weeks. You don't have to do any finger sticks. And then you can get, you can look at your glucose like this on your phone any moment. You can see your glucose. Or you can look at it on your watch, and you just, here it is, I've just been having some refreshments, 149. But also you can look at the trends over the last 3, 6, 12 hours. So there's a lot of information you can get now. I wouldn't necessarily do that as part of an office visit because the patient doesn't have a sensor on, but it just gives an example, the exquisite amount of information, real-time streaming about a person's real-world data.
And so all you really needed there was an Apple Watch and a tiny sensor that's about the shape of a dime.
Exactly.
You can track your blood sugar. Right. So what about patients? What are the tools that you're seeing some of your own patients using in your practice?
Well, I think increasingly the ability to take your blood pressure through the phone. So this is there's a few devices now, particularly iHealth and Withings, that you can just plug that device. There's a wrist cuff that is really easy. It has no wires. You put it on your wrist, and you connect through Bluetooth through your smartphone, and now you have all your blood pressures being tracked. The difference with that and this watch, which is waiting for FDA approval, this gets your blood pressure without testing. This watch here is actually a Qantas watch, and it has the real one has a face that will show your blood pressure every heartbeat. And that you don't have to press start. So you don't, even while you're sleeping, if you want to wear your watch or you're in traffic or you're having stress, an argument with somebody, you'll have your blood pressure. The ones that exist today that you can buy, which again are very inexpensive, they're the same as if you were bought the traditional Omron blood pressure cuff in cost. But they will give you beautiful data visualization of your blood pressure. And for people, 70 million people in this country have hypertension. And so a lot of people not only don't even know it, but they also don't have it managed well, and they don't know what it is under stressful circumstances. So this is a great thing. The doctor office one-off contrived blood pressure, that's not worth a whole lot. What's much better is the person taking lots of measurements on their own, and what's even better is when they don't even have to press start, mm-hmm. when it's just happening seamlessly without them knowing it.
So a lot of the people that I meet today that are sort of early to this wearables trend are people that are, on the whole, fairly healthy. And they're using devices like the Fitbit that's been around for about 7 years now. Some people call this category the worried well. How does this really change healthcare?
Well, I saw a good phrase to summarize the Fitbit as the quit bit. Because it really doesn't last for most people very long. The idea of counting steps, I mean, how many of you count steps now? Every day, you do that? Okay, most people give up after a stretch. You know, they find out what it takes to do 10,000 steps, and they say, okay, I got it. And it's like training wheels to ride a bicycle or something. But most people either lose these devices, not just the Fitbit, the other ones, or they just kind of give up. Usually by a month or two, there's a very relatively low rate of adherence. And the problem is steps is not really, that's a lifestyle thing. It's important. We want people to be more active. And in fact, in current smartwatches, they track steps and smartphones track steps without even needing another device. Who needs another device to lose or buy or charge or whatever. So I think the transition here is away from these devices that are lifestyle to actual medical metrics that are relevant, like the ones we're talking about, and there's a whole lot more, of course.
Yeah, and are you seeing people who have medical conditions, maybe one or more conditions like diabetes and heart disease, actually using these devices?
Yeah, in fact, the big three right now, I've already touched on them, blood pressure, having a device. Most people who have high blood pressure ought to have a device that they're getting frequent measurements. The electrocardiogram for people with heart arrhythmias is a biggie. And then glucose for diabetics. You know, in fact, it's going to happen in the future whereby this becomes so inexpensive that we won't be seeing finger sticks anymore. That's something that doesn't go over well in public. It's a nuisance. It's painful. It's relatively expensive. But soon enough, we'll have people, even if they're pre-diabetic and they're worried about progressing to diabetes, being able to monitor. And that obviously has a big deal as far as complications, not just from the heart and blood vessels, but, you know, far beyond that. So those are the big ones. But there's many more. In the future, collecting all the data for people with asthma, so their air quality, pollen count, lung function, vital signs, oxygen saturation, to know before a person even has a wheeze that they're about to have an asthma attack. Or people with depression. You know, it's amazing how many people are taking medications for depression. It's almost like 1 of 7 adults in this country. And the fact is we've never been able to quantify it. But now we have all these ways through voice, tone, and inflection, facial recognition, vital signs, galvanic skin response. I mean, it's just the list goes on and on. Your breathing pattern. So much rich information can now be collected through and get a feedback loop. And I call this another wisdom of the body. So the famous wisdom of the body is how our bodies are basically programmed to keep our fluid status and our electrolytes and our glucose and blood pressure all auto-regulated. But now there's this new smartphone information hub that's giving you that information as an external loop, and it's really quite exciting.
And speaking about wisdom, let's talk about one of your favorite historical figures, Hippocrates, who said, and this is a quote, "Most things should be kept from the patient." And you've argued in your book that that kind of thinking has really still exists today, and you've traced this history of medical paternalism. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. I actually didn't understand the depth and the whole lineage of medical paternalism, Christina. I there hasn't really been a book dedicated to this subject. And in fact, in order to understand it, it really had to piece together a lot of different sources. But what I found was actually astounding. That, you know, like most doctors in graduate med school, you take the Hippocratic Oath and you don't really know that much about Hippocrates. Then you find out this father of medicine, 400 BC, was the one that said, hide everything, as you said, from the patient. Don't tell the patient because that will alarm and make them sicker. And that's basically what we have all the way through more than two millennia later. We have doctors that don't want to give information because patients are suppressed. I call them the Rodney Dangerfields, you know, don't get no respect. And that's basically what we have. We have a situation where doctors, and I'm, you know, one of the older generation, we believe that, you know, this the whole notion of this noble profession of the doctor knows best, the medical deity, MD, all this kind of stuff, we got to get over this. It's a real problem.
And in your book, you've criticized a lot of these physicians and physician groups for vaunting the profession as noble. And I think at one point you called it a self-aggrandizing orgy. And at the same time, undermining the role of the patient. How do you see this in sort of more detail? How do you see this affecting the doctor-patient relationship?
Well, the good part is that doctor-patient relationship, for the most part, has been this real serious problem of asymmetrical information. The doctor had access to the information. Doctor ordered to get information like labs and scans and whatnot done. And the patient couldn't get that information or had to beg and still can't get their office notes. Two-thirds of people can't in this country can't even get their office notes because the doctors don't believe they should have them. So we're going to move to a different time because patients are generating their own data, as we've been starting to introduce. And this information symmetry is getting established. So the gap and the power that resided on the doctor's side is quickly going to move to parity. And we have this partnership, new way of going forward. And I think that's really exciting, and it's a long time coming.
I'm Christina Farr, editor of the KQED blog, Future of You, in conversation with Eric Topol, cardiologist and the author of The Patient Will See You Now. So let's talk a little bit more about that. You mentioned at one point ownership of data, and this is important because, you know, you juxtapose that with sort of access to data. And right now, patients really only have limited access, but not ownership. Do you see that changing at all with patients now generating their own data rather than their doctors?
Right. So what's really interesting now is that, first of all, where do you go in the world today where you pay for things and you have no product, no work product? You don't own anything. And you're lucky if you can get access to what you paid for. And by the way, it happens to be your body, your precious body that you have a vested interest in. Does that make any sense? So there's something that's really screwed up there. But what's fortunate that's happening right now is that you're going to be generating more and more data that will overwhelm the mass of data that's in your electronic record, which still today, in spite of the things that have been done in the Affordable Care Act, is still difficult to access in a meaningful way. So pretty soon you're going to have all this data, and if you can find a home for it, which is the thing that's missing right now, like a personal cloud, an electronic record locker, if you will, that has all your information, then that's the beginning of ownership. And in fact, everyone should own their medical information, because almost all people go to different providers, different health systems. They travel. They go to different places where they might get ill. They should have their information immediately on them or accessible to them, because they own it and they paid for it. So we have to get this thing fixed. It is completely off track, and it's partly an outgrowth of the way it was for all these years.
You mentioned earlier about accessing your doctor's notes and sort of struggles around that. In 2012, three top medical centers conducted an experiment where doctors actually did share their notes with their patients. And overall, it was a success. Nothing terrible happened. But still, a more recent study showed that only 30% of doctors even support this practice. What do you think about that resistance?
Yeah, it's actually pretty amazing. These three prestigious medical centers in Boston, Beth Israel Deaconess, in Pennsylvania, Geisinger, and then Harborview in Seattle, they worked together to try this open notes idea. And what it was that doctors didn't think the patients should get the notes, should have access to their notes of the office, because they put things in there like, the patient SOB, and the patient would think, oh, you know, this calling me an SOB, and they're using simple terms for shortness of breath. Or they might say the patient is obese, and the patient doesn't say, I'm not obese, and get all upset. So the doctors didn't like the idea of the patient seeing what they wrote in their notes. And the patients wanted to try this experiment. And what's interesting is the doctors all thought it was going to create a lot of work, a lot of anxiety, and they didn't really want much part of it. By the end of the experiment, all the doctors do this routinely. They love it. And all the patients, of course, love it. And this is one remarkable demonstration project that a lot of the fears of anxiety and inducing people going cuckoo from seeing their records were unfounded, just totally off base. Now, when I posted a blog about that we need to let go and give our medical records office notes to patients, I got an alarming response from doctors saying, I created the record. I own the record. And they just don't get it. It's a real problem. We have to get over a serious attitudinal, historical, embedded problem.
Back to mobile health and the future of medicine. One of the favorite stories that I read in your book is about how you've used your modern black bag, which you showed us today, on emergency situations in planes. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you've been able to help people in distress on flights?
Well, the one thing I'd say is to warn you, if you ever see me boarding a plane, don't go on that plane because it might have an emergency medical problem. I seem to have some bad luck in that regard. But no, I the first one was a patient actually had a heart attack. And we couldn't tell because, you know, there's not that much on the plane in terms of medical equipment.
And Wi-Fi, right?
No, well, the Wi-Fi wouldn't help. But fortunately, the patient had some chest pain and he actually... symptoms were suggestive of a heart attack. He was sweating. He had chest pressure, a lot of abdominal discomfort. But when I did the cardiogram with the device just like this and did all the leads of the chest, it was obvious that this was a major heart attack, and it led to an emergency landing. The other ones that have come up since, and there's been three more, I've had more equipment than just a cardiogram, and I could sort out what was going on much better because the equipments now are really building out, and so can make the diagnosis. One, it was a woman with a thyroid storm with a fast atrial fibrillation. One was a fellow who passed out that had arrhythmia shortly after takeoff. And the most recent one was another interesting fellow, just happened just a few weeks ago, who I still don't know what happened finally, because when we landed, it was an American Airlines. They whisked him off. We had the ambulance all arranged to take him, and now they won't tell me what happened to him. You know, they used the HIPAA abuse. There's so much of that. So, I mean, I actually took care of the fellow, and I still don't know the final result, but at least he made it to the airport, you know, the gate okay, with the paramedics who I gave report to with all the data.
Do you remember his name in case he's listening to this broadcast?
No, actually, I only got his first name, and I know where he lives, kind of what town and what he did, but, you know, beyond that, I wish I could have gotten more. I hope he's doing well. I trust he is, but he definitely was having a tough time on that flight.
All right, well, I hope he reaches out.
I hope so.
Recently, you were on Colbert, the Colbert Show. Mm-hmm. And
old Colbert Show.
R.I.P. And you used a number of devices on Stephen Colbert, including a mobile otoscope called a cellscope.
Right.
And I think you gave the audience a close-up of Colbert's inner ear, which must have been quite a sight. So can you talk to me a little bit about that experience and what kind of reactions you've had from it, especially from other doctors?
Well, I think it was funny. He's a wild and crazy guy, everybody knows. And when I, you know, with the audience was of pretty much a similar demographics as here, you know, really young, spirited audience. So when I showed the eardrum, you know, they were all oohing and aahing, and he started with his jokes about, you know, it's my eardrum, not my ass, and all that stuff. But what got cut out of that whole segment, which really is disquieting to some extent, was the best part. And I tried to get that clip of it, but I had never been successful. So I had been warned that he's, you know, kind of tough, and you have to be, you know, kind of stand up, otherwise he'll just kind of bowl you over. So I had the ultrasound, you know, handheld my stethoscope device with me, and I asked him if I could examine his heart. And so he said, okay, and he opened up his shirt, which is the first time he's ever done that in a segment, and people were oohing and aahing about that. I think they thought he was going to have a big eagle tattoo or something. I don't know. And so then I examined his heart, but I had this thing ready to, and I had not warned the producer about it. And I said, oh, Stephen, it looks like you have a dissecting aortic aneurysm. And he said, what? And he looked really worried. I said, no, just kidding. Anyway, so that got cut out. And all the other stuff that was with it. So, like, right after that, you know, he said, don't tell me the sex of the baby. And, you know, all these other jokes. I mean, he's so fast, so incredibly fast. So he helped bring to life the excitement of some of these devices. And he's just, his humor is really in a rarefied group, no question.
Well, we hope we get to see those clips one day.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to extract them, but I tried. I tried all the things I could to get them because they're pretty darn funny, and very few people have ever gotten him on a joke, you know, so I thought this was a unique experience.
And what kind of reaction did you get from people that watched the show? And I'm especially wondering about other doctors who might not believe that digital health is quite so transformative as you do.
Well, I think there's a lot of physicians who are skeptical. Some of it's for good reason, because some of these technologies need to be validated with, you know, careful, rigorous trials to prove that they do what they're supposed to do and they have good outcomes and they're inexpensive. In fact, lower costs. That's the real promise and the excitement. But one of the biggest things, Christina, is the issue of losing control. This is a really fundamental problem, is that because the technology and this infrastructure, the digital, mobile, you know, pervasive connectivity is changing the rest of the world, it's changing medicine, it's empowering individuals to the likes of which a lot of doctors can't handle this because they've been autonomous. They've been ruling the roost. And so for people to be generating their data, that basically has been dissed. You bring in your data to the doctor. That's not worth very much. I didn't order that data. I don't know where that came from. So we have a problem with control, and this we have to get over this. This is really, as you pointed out earlier, an outgrowth of this long-standing embedded paternalism.
I'm Christina Farr, editor of the KQED blog Future of You, in conversation with Eric Topol, cardiologist and author of The Patient Will See You Now. And now we're going to take some questions from the audience. So let's talk about money. Healthcare today still operates in this model that we call fee-for-service, where doctors are paid when patients are sick rather than for keeping them healthy. How do you see a lot of these mobile health and digital health tools that you were showing me earlier fitting into that world?
Well, for one, we're still at the early stages that these devices all can be attached to algorithms. So, for example, if we just use that cardiogram, you wouldn't need me to tell you it's normal. You could just get the software to say, what does it show? And all these things, in terms of any medical metric, in fact, integrated medical metrics, will give you, without a doctor, information. So we're talking about cheap chips. This is Moore's Law. 50 years into Moore's Law, we're getting cheap chips into medicine, and software, which is basically free once it's written, although obviously there's some charge for it. So we're talking about very inexpensive things to change what the patient's processing their data, and then only going to a doctor for specific guidance, you know, the wisdom and experience of the doctor, and the treatment side. Because most of these things, people aren't going to be treating themselves. They're going to be diagnostic monitoring functions, but not treatment functions. So then we have this new reset where you have this partnership where the doctor is providing a different part of most of their functions, you know, a vast majority of diagnosis monitoring done by patients. And so your point about the fee for service, well, there's a lot less need for these encounters because they're much more shunted to I need guidance. I've got all my data. I've got the diagnosis, at least from the algorithms and machine learning about me and all my data. Now I need your help. What should I do?
While we're on the topic of money, we've had a question from the audience about a company that has certainly raised a lot, and that's Theranos. Do you think that Theranos, which is a lab testing company that claims to be able to take blood with a mere drop, do you think that company will be life changing?
It's a good question. In just recent weeks, the last few weeks, there's been a big momentum at the FDA to give Theranos a so-called CLIA waiver, where they can not just have the sample of this so-called nanotainer with a couple of droplets of blood, but actually, it could be done at a Walgreens drugstore or ultimately in the home. This CLIA waiver is a big deal. It's only for one test right now, but it's basically their platform. Their whole testing has been validated by FDA. So while there's been a lot of doubt about Theranos, this recent advance is a signal that they may be for real. And this, I have, when I first met Elizabeth Holmes, who is a has quickly become kind of a legend around these parts, because she set out almost a decade ago to have this creative destruction of lab medicine. And to me, the most telling story is her Stanford professor told her, don't drop out, Elizabeth. Don't drop out of Stanford after her first year. And now, years later, that professor works for her. So that may tell you something. But I think it's one of many things that are changing medicine, because you could do all your labs through your smartphone. You don't have to go to the drugstore. And so pretty quickly, whether it's your electrolytes, obviously your glucose, your blood counts, thyroid function, liver function, kidney function, the long, long list. In fact, even diagnosing infections will be done through your smartphone. That's really exciting, and this is all part of this liberation, this emancipation from a very ossified medical community.
It sounds like we're going to be raising, a lot more data in the future, especially with a company like Theranos. And you recently tweeted this amazing and terrifying graphic that showed that you're far more likely to have your medical record hacked than you are to ever access it.
Yeah.
And I think that's...
Well, I was actually amazed by this. So I don't know if you've been following the medical hacking since 2008, but we're talking about, hundreds of millions of hacks. The biggest one of Anthem, 80 million earlier this year, but just last week, UCLA, 4.5 million electronic records at UCLA were hacked. And so it's over a 5-to-1 ratio of people's electronic records having been hacked as compared to the people who actually even tried to access their record. So we have a serious problem with privacy and security. I mean, major. And we have nothing being done. We have these White House wonderful white papers that are written, but no action. And this requires legislation. It requires technological issues to come to be used. But there's a way out of this mess. And privacy and security today, there's nothing being done. So when you do a Google search, you buy something through Amazon, there's all these data brokers with your data. And if that's happening with your medical data, that's a serious breach. People do not want to give up privacy of their medical data.
Another question from the audience about health data. We've had a comment that it sounds nice to have increased access through companies like Theranos, but how do we ensure that patients don't overreact and intervene counterproductively? Human beings, after all, have a bias towards intervention.
Right. So there's this thing about too much information and cyberchondriacs, right? So you have, back in the 90s when the internet really went live, people would look up things, still today, and then whatever they looked up, they had that disease. You know, immediately they were, these are the real beginning of cyberchondria. But the problem is that those are people looking up about other people, and now they're going to have their own data. And so the one thing for sure is some people are too wired, they're too anxious. They shouldn't be messing with this stuff. This is not for them. But for the most people, we're talking about if you do surveys, large consumer surveys, 80, 85%, 90% want all their data, all their medical data, and they believe, justifiably, they can handle it with the right interpretation, the right coaching. So most people do well, but there are some people who can't handle getting this kind of information. It makes them extremely anxious, and we want to avoid that. Plus, we also have a generation of people, for example, you know, octogenarians and older super seniors. They are used to being submissive in the medical world. They're not going to want to have all their data. They wouldn't know what to do with it. And so, for the most part, there are exceptions, of course. So it's not for everyone. Everything we're talking about this evening is for people who want it. It's an opt-in sort of thing.
And speaking of products that are not for everyone, a question from the audience. What do you think about the Apple Watch, and what will the impact be in the next 12 months?
Yeah, I think the Apple Watch is just getting off the ground. I always look at things from the medical standpoint. So the fact that diabetics can look at their watch and see their glucose and see what's happening at any moment, or a mother with two diabetic children can follow their children, you know, remotely. These are good steps through their watch without even having to pull out their phone, and so accessible. The fact you can get medication adherence. I had a patient, I tweeted about, it wasn't my patient, but another cardiologist. Amazing story. I talked to him on the phone last week. So really fascinating. He was very dizzy, and he had one of the early purchasing of an Apple Watch. And he was looking at his watch and just at rest, and he saw that his heart rate would go from 40 to 110, 35, 130, you know, back and forth. And he said, there must be something wrong with this watch, but he's really dizzy and lightheaded. And so he Googled this. So what is it? How you can be dizzy and have your heart rate have this wild fluctuations? And he says, oh my gosh, I have sick sinus syndrome. So he makes an appointment for the cardiologist because he reads that a pacemaker is the treatment for sick sinus syndrome. So he goes in, he gets the pacemaker. It was confirmed that was a diagnosis, in fact, which he got from his Apple Watch and Googling the data. And he got a wireless pacemaker put in an hour later, and he's 100%. I just talked to him. He's doing great. So there are these reports. And actually, it was kind of interesting. Tim Cook favorited that tweet, interestingly. I just think this. We're just seeing the beginning. Remember, some of you will remember the iPhone in 07 and how that was essentially an early prototype. That, oh my gosh, I can surf the web, kind of, and I can do all this stuff, and how it quickly advanced. And I see the same thing for the Apple Watch. I believe eventually it'll integrate the blood pressures, the mood metrics, you know, quantifying mood, and for each individual with particular apps, it may not even be the Apple Watch, it'll be other watches that'll get track all the relevant data for the condition they're trying to prevent or better treat.
A question from Rock Health, the healthcare investing firm that is hosting us tonight. We talk a lot about startups as the future of healthcare innovation, but certainly there must be some established players that will lead us towards the future of health. Which larger companies do you think are most promising?
Well, I think it's really interesting because up until now, we've never seen the tech titans really come into medicine. They made some early passes, like, you know, back several years ago, Google and Microsoft tried to get into health records, and they abandoned that because it was impossible. They realized that they were dealing with the Tower of Babel in the medical community. But they've now come back, not just Google and Microsoft, but now we have Apple, we have IBM in a big way, Salesforce, Intel, Qualcomm. They're all in this, and they're all in. And so this is really remarkable because we've got now very powerful computing capabilities coming into the medical space, and it's something that we have desperately needed, and we'll see this now equilibration with the rest of our worlds. You know, every other sector of our lives have been digitized except for our medical world, and that's about to change.
Here's a great question from the audience. As we are seeing digital health data monitoring devices flood the market, are you concerned at all about oversight from the FDA or any other regulatory bodies here or abroad that might slow down this innovation?
I am concerned. In fact, before we got started, I was talking to one of the startups that's developing a device to basically prevent tremor for people with essential tremor, which is a very common condition. And, you know, it's a therapeutic device, but it has no risk. I'm saying, well, why can't this thing get approved very quickly? Because there's a lot of people with tremor who they are really debilitated, and it's socially, you know, very troubling. And this is the kind of thing that should have a streamlined path. Now, some of the devices I've shown, like the electrocardiogram, the glucose, the blood pressure things I've mentioned, they've been approved by FDA, and they've gone pretty quickly. So there hasn't been consistency, and we'd like to streamline this. And, in fact, there's a big bill right now called 21st Century Cures. I don't like the name of it, but it's part of that bill, besides getting a lot more money to the NIH, is about getting the FDA approvals more efficient. So I'd love to see that get passed.
Well, we'll be watching C-SPAN and keeping an eye on it for those of us that are nerdy. Have you seen any physicians skeptical of digital health turn towards the light, meaning that they had some kind of shift in thinking? And what caused them to finally think differently and wake up to this space?
Well, I think it's a very small minority, but it's happening. Among people, a lot of the young cardiologists, trainees I've had it at Scripps, you know, to use a handheld ultrasound to do the heart exam instead of a stethoscope. And as soon as they started seeing the heart in a minute, every aspect of it, rather than listening to Lub Dub, they got immediate conversion. So it really takes, when a patient sends you their cardiogram and they have this heart rhythm and they already have the correct diagnosis and they never went to an emergency room, you say, oh my gosh, this is pretty remarkable. And the more that doctors are exposed to patients getting into their own diagnostic capabilities and monitoring functions with the appropriate interpretations, I think this is going to drive it. It's a little bit like, you know how drug companies hit the airways, TV, with all these ads to ask your doctor. And that is a big force. And drug companies have figured out, unfortunately, that advertising on TV is a way to get to doctors. Well, it's the same kind of model here. The more people have their data and use it to improve their health, the more doctors will come along.
So some of the criticisms of your books have pointed out that you don't touch enough on some of the drawbacks of digital health, and those include what we've mentioned already, potential security hacks and privacy violations. The New York Times wrote, "Down here in the trenches, no one is likely to consent to cloud storage of the genome, let alone electronic sensors in the bloodstream anytime soon." Do you see this as a very legitimate concern?
Well, it's interesting. You know, that was a review, one of the early reviews from a New York Times, a physician who was really tough on the book. And if you look, actually, the consumer reviews on Amazon, for example, you know, it's pretty close to 5-star reviews. And what's the difference? Doctors threatened, or at least one or a few of them, and don't understand the capabilities and never been exposed to this, versus consumers who say, I want this. I want to have much more charge. It's my body, it's my health, and I want to have a lot more ownership and engagement. And so that's the difference here. We're seeing some very reluctant, recalcitrant physicians, some, and unfortunately, a couple of them were actually reviewers of the book. Now, that doesn't mean there are not issues here. Privacy and security for me are center stage. Proof, validation, you know, that is really important. But one of the biggest problems is we have this bottleneck where we have, you're going to have all this data flowing continuously about you. And who's going to put that all together? Who's going to tell you, your virtual medical coach, on your, so instead of you telling you where your next appointment or that there's traffic, it's going to say, you know what, you haven't slept right the last few days, your blood pressure's creeping up 8 millimeters, your glucose is this, and, you know, giving you recommendations about it before you wind up with something happening, before the plane crash. And so this is a sort of thing that's going to start to happen more. And when we get the virtual medical coach going, that's a bottleneck of data analytics, predictive analytics, machine learning, contextual computing. That's what's missing right now. So my biggest concerns are that we're not actually developing the technology and validating it as much and securing it as much. So eventually that'll happen.
And to your point about the lack of external validation around these devices, when do you think we will see doctors feeling as if they are trustworthy enough and that they're willing to really accept them within their medical practice?
Well, that's a really tough one because change in medicine takes a long time. I mean, you know, typically we're talking about well over a decade, even close to 2 decades, and we're now just a few years into this movement. But it will come from consumers. I don't know if there's going to be a health spring to start to have marches and activists, but there are some activist patients out there that are outspoken, and it's great. Much more participant type of story. I think the biggest likely story that you'll see in the next year or so will be one of the largest firms that have employers that have hundreds of thousands of employees, and they are paying billions of dollars a year for healthcare. And they know there's a much better way to go. And in fact, giving their employees, their family members, the power of information and much less expense. And one of these, all it takes is just one of these companies to take the leadership, and then we'll have a cascade of others. And that's, I think, will be the likely wavefront of change.
And do you see the opposite scenario in which one of these companies has some kind of a flaw with the data and that leads to a situation that's very negative for a patient?
Sure, that could happen. You know, computers don't always work right all the time. We all have had experiences like that. So that's one of the good things why one of the companies that could do this hasn't yet taken the leap, because a lot of these things are just getting better every day and more and, you know, richer opportunities. But I think it won't be long before we give this a big start. It'll be a pilot, of course, first. It won't be every employee of that company, but it'll march on. And then they'll say, oh, my gosh, we can save $1 billion a year? Oh, wow. And our employees are so much happier and healthier. This is great. And that will, I think, we still live in this country as basically an employer-based health system. So it takes that system to really drive the change, I think.
A question from the audience. Is clinical efficiency, in addition to a focus on user-centered design, enough to make consumer health technology stick with users and avoid the junk drawer? And how should consumer companies set themselves up for success in the clinical world?
Well, the main thing is that they are fully directing their efforts to consumers. There's not enough of that now. A lot of startups today are still thinking, how do we get doctors to buy into this stuff? And that's really probably the wrong idea, because this is going to be quickly moving towards a consumer-centric world of medicine. And that's all been held back, not just by, you know, the paternalism, but the information gulf, which is going to basically go away and shift, you know, in favor of patients. So I think the problem I've seen repeatedly is the voice of the consumer, the voice of the individual not being as emphasized and prioritized as it should be.
Speaking of kind of recent articles about cost savings around digital health, we've actually seen some that have speculated the opposite, that some of these new tools, especially those that claim to diagnose patients, will lead to the overuse of medicine and more costs, not less. So how do you think this trend of more consumer-friendly diagnostic tools will impact the use of the healthcare system?
Well, we've done studies. We actually published one in the New England Journal using genomics. It didn't lead to any more tests. It actually led to less in many individuals and appropriate testing and screening. But recently, we just did a randomized trial where we gave people smartphones, data plans, and the electrocardiogram app, the glucose, and the blood pressure. And what we found was, in fact, there was no increase in cost. There was a control arm. That is, the patient didn't have any of that stuff. And it's really important that we start to do more research to prove the point that patients having their own data is not leading to runaway costs, but rather just the opposite, that we can actually cut costs remarkably. Let me just show you one other tool here that I think this one is pretty impressive. This is a Band-Aid. It costs about $1 to make, right? And it has you know, hundreds of millions of transistors in it. Like, by the way, your smartphone has over 2 billion transistors in it. But anyway, this Band-Aid you can put on at night, and it gets all your metrics, like your oxygen saturation, your respiratory rate, your heart rate, heart rhythm, and other things, heart rate variability. So here's your choice. You think you may have sleep apnea, right? Common condition, serious condition. And you could go to a hospital sleep lab and someone pays, $3,500 to $7,000, $10,000 for a sleep in a hospital sleep lab. I don't know anyone could sleep normally in a hospital sleep lab. And by the way, I don't know anyone who's ever had a normal study in a hospital sleep lab. I always have some kind of abnormality. Well, of course. What about if you just put this on your body at night and collect the data, you know, and send it in the mail, you know, and it costs like nothing. That's an example of cheap chips, and that's one of the most lucrative centers in a hospital today is the hospital sleep lab, amazingly. So I'm just giving you an example of the kind of ways things can change and people having their own data at a fraction of the cost, really.
I'm Christina Farr, editor of Future of You, KQED's blog about the intersection of technology and medicine, and we're here tonight with Dr. Eric Topol, author of The Patient Will See You Now. So one of your other areas of interest is genetics, and we haven't touched on it very much tonight, but I did want to ask you about 23andMe, the company that was offering direct-to-consumer genetic testing that the FDA cracked down on several years ago. What was your sort of take on that whole episode, and are you sympathetic to 23andMe?
Well, I am sympathetic because they were the first and largest force to try to democratize genomics and get genomic data to consumers at a price point of $99, which is the price point for all this stuff. If it isn't less than $99, it doesn't have a whole lot of chance for success because this is out of pocket often, typically. So they did that. They amassed, you know, almost a million people, the largest genomic repository in the world. But they got beat up by the FDA because they did two bad things. One is that they didn't communicate with the FDA for several months. Not a good thing when they're sending you letters. And then at the same time, they launched a multi-million dollar TV aggressive campaign. That doesn't go over too well with the FDA when people send them the commercials to watch. So that basically led to them being taken out. But they're starting to come back now because they've gotten approval in a very formal way. And I am all for that type of entity. Right now we're seeing other companies doing, through saliva, cancer genomic predisposition, like Color Genomics and Veritas Genetics. And so this Angelina effect, as it's called, where a large public figure had a wake-up call to the public about the power of genomics. And, you know, 23andMe was in front of that by years. And they actually provided for 30 drugs, all your interactions with 30 commonly used drugs, so you could avoid major side effects or not taking a drug that wouldn't work in you, which, by the way, about 80% of drugs that we take, or 80% of people don't respond on average to a drug that they're taking every day. So that's a step in the right direction, getting that information. So I think 23andMe had the right idea. They had a little problem with execution there. Hopefully they'll get back on track. And it's great to see these other consumer genomics-oriented companies starting to really get going now.
And bigger picture than that, what's your take on the White House's precision medicine or personalized medicine initiative? Do you see it as kind of more hype than anything else?
Well, no, I think it's a good thing. President Obama's into it. Precision medicine is the term. I'm not into that term so much. I like individualized medicine because it's about the individual's Google medical map or GIS and the individual's driving it. But precision doesn't, for me, doesn't make it, but that's the term. We got to live with that.
We're stuck with it.
Stuck with it, yeah. Any rate, I think it's a great thing because it's getting legs, it's getting formed. It doesn't have the budget, I don't think, allocated, and what it's been asked for is small compared to what's required. But as I mentioned, Christina, our medication use is completely off base. We prescribe medicines that don't even work in most people. When we have people with cancer, we don't sequence their tumor, no less the other definition, to give them the right drugs. And the list goes on and on. So we're not using genomics. We're not using digital devices. We're not getting individuals engaged as they should. So many of the things of this precision medicine initiative are things that I really believe in. They're really about democratizing medicine and drilling down for high definition of each of us for better health.
And are you, these areas that you mentioned, for instance, cancer genomics, are these the areas that are likely to get funding from this project?
In fact, the first phase of that is mostly going to be cancer genomics, yes. So that's going to be the emphasis. And I think we've already seen genomics had a mega impact. I mean, this is actually astounding. In the first few years of this fetal sequencing, so-called non-invasive prenatal tests, which is four companies and more that are getting out there, who offered this test, we now have had over 800,000 women in the last year have this test, which is one-fifth of all pregnancies, to have a blood test. And now amniocentesis is starting to go towards extinction, which is not a good procedure to have to go through for a woman with a risk, a small risk, but an absolute risk of infection or miscarriage and big anxiety having this needle put into the amniotic fluid. So now we have genomic sequencing of the fetus at 8-10 weeks with a single tube of blood with enormous amount of information. That shows you the power of genomics. And that's happened even before there was a precision medicine initiative. So we're going to see a lot more of that going forward. And I think that's probably the best example to think that one-fifth and soon to be one-half of all pregnancies are being tracked, the fetus, that way is astounding.
That's very rapid, the development of those companies.
Yeah, I mean, this all happened in just a few years, and it's on this very steep slope of acceptance.
Wow. So you've mentioned already some criticism around the FDA and hopes of reform, but you've also been quite positive of the government, especially with the Affordable Care Act. So overall, can you talk a little bit about sort of how you feel, you know, the government is doing as like a stumbling block or a potential supporter of digital health?
Well, I actually think it's the Unaffordable Care Act. I have problems with it. I think the great thing is getting access for every American should have health care coverage. And we shouldn't be beholden to a job. They don't want to be in that job just because it provides health coverage. I mean, there's got to be a better way. There's better models around the rest of the world. So it's great that it's improved access and gotten rid of a lot of the issues about pre-existing conditions and things like that. But what's happening right now is that the insurers are raising their rates big time, 20, 30, 40%. And while they have to get approvals for that, they're going to probably get approvals. And so our costs in that regard are going in the wrong direction. But more important to me is the part of the Affordable Care Act was putting $40 billion into health information to give doctors incentives to do electronic records. And I can't think of a better way that $40 billion were wasted than that. You know, it hasn't changed anything. We have the Tower of Babel I alluded to earlier. We have all these companies with their vendors, electronic records. They don't talk to each other. You go to this doctor, he has that kind of record. This doctor has that kind of record. And it's really ridiculous. If they're going to put money into this as part of the Affordable Care, they should have demanded teeth, not responding to lobbyists, that if these don't all work together, you're out of here. You know, so we have a problem with a health lobby for the government that's profound. I mean, it's right up there with guns and tobacco, and it's really a problem. And we don't see, I don't get into politics too much. I abhor that whole area, but it's been distressing to see the lack of wise use of the funding, the lack of NIH support that is struggling. So many things that we could do better. I mean, that $40 billion could have really been a big bang for medicine in the recent years, and it's gone for naught.
And that's a topic that we've certainly covered quite a bit at KQED, the sort of issues around interoperability and electronic medical records and how they don't talk to each other. But we're running out of time, so unfortunately we can't dig into it further. But I did want to ask before we wrapped up if there are one or two trends that we should be keeping an eye out for in digital health and mobile health?
That's a good one, Christina. I'm thinking that the trends really are people need to demand their information, and they're going to do it more and more. They're not going to put up with that they can't get it. That, you know, you went to a visit, that should be your data. The lab tests, you know, that's one of the things, going back to the questioner that asked about Theranos, you get the lab tests right then. And in fact, in Arizona, and if you can order it yourself, or LabCorp, you can order your own lab test. So this whole idea of being much more in charge is the trend. That's the mega trend. And I think each person has that ability, but it's really interesting. Among young people, it's digital natives, they're kind of natural, saying, I want my data. But for the people who've been suppressed so long, they think it's the way it is. That's the way they have to deal with this. So I think we need to get pushed along by the younger folks who realize that the digital era is a different one.
So we should get out there and demand to see our data.
And I think the younger folks have to teach their parents, their older family members, friends, that don't put up with this stuff. That it's time to, you know, establish ownership. You should have all your records. I mean, I just tried this. It's another startup in this area called Picnic Health. And I got every scan, lab test, all charted for the past 25 years on a mobile app. I can look at it anytime. Why shouldn't everybody have that? And why should the government have put $40 billion to that so everyone did have that? So in the future, we'll see that trend. We need to get this activism pushed to the max to hopefully get there sooner, so we don't just sit around waiting for it to happen.
And what would happen if everyone rushed over to the hospital and demanded access to their data tomorrow?
They wouldn't get very much. It would be a gobbledygook. Everything that you get these days is kind of claim-oriented. It's not, you know, the right kind of data. And that's why you need these entrepreneurial companies that have figured out written software to make it so that anyone could understand it and read it and pull it all together for you. And if you have a scan, you should have that scan. So that, you know, by the way, over 10% of scans, you probably have gotten that in the past, over 10% of medical scans are done over again because the patient can't get the scan. So they just order a new one. And oftentimes this is imposing a lot radiation costs, all kinds of issues. And this is just all part of this lack of ownership problem. So I'd love to see this demand ownership. And we have some leaders in the government who are pushing access is enough, and access is not enough. I mean, you got to own it. And we have a forthcoming paper on this very topic coming out. And there's a movement called Unpatients. It's a nonprofit foundation, Unpatients. So that's the kind of, as you're getting back to that, what's the trend? I hope that we'll see a lot more of that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening, Dr. Eric Topol, author of The Patient Will See You Now. And thanks for coming tonight and to Walk Health for hosting us. I'm Christina Farr, editor of Future of You, KQED's blog about the intersection of technology and medicine.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Thank you.